Hello and welcome to another episode of History Lesson Part 2. I'm Jackson McDonald.
I'm Tyler Shipley.
The movie we will be discussing, or I suppose maybe a better way to put it would be movies we'll be discussing today, are the Knives Out cinematic universe, Knives Out, and more specifically, Glass Onion, a Knives Out mystery, written and directed by Rian Johnson. We alluded to this in the last episode that we recorded when we were talking about our favorite movies of the year. Tyler had Glass Onion on his list. I had Glass Onion on my worst of list, and that kind of inspired us to talk about it a little bit more in depth, because I know at least the first time I saw Glass Onion, I was just like mentally writing out a list of shit I hated about it, which, you know, really wasn't my intention, actually. I tried to go into it with an open mind. And I liked Knives Out. So, you know, I had every reason to believe that I might like Glass Onion as well. So maybe that's where we should start. Tyler, you just watched, rewatched Knives Out last night, right?
Yeah, I went back and I liked it at the time, but I hadn't thought about it much. And, you know, when Glass Onion came out, I also watched it. I had the opposite reaction to you, which is that I initially liked it a lot, and then the more I thought about it, the less I liked it. But yesterday I went back and I watched the original Knives Out, and it definitely holds up. It definitely is good. I mean, Glass Onion ultimately for me, I'm going to say, is just like a pale imitation of the original Knives Out, which sure, did all of the same things, had the same goals, but did them much more effectively and much funnier and tighter and better written. You know, I assume everyone who's listening, you know, already sort of knows these two movies. But I mean, the first Knives Out is a murder mystery, you know, send up of the rich that takes place in a mansion and has all of the trappings of the classic murder mystery, and it works. And it plays really well. And each of the different rich people that are being satirized, they feel real. They feel like,
yeah.
I mean, you know that they're sort of satirical, like conglomerations of certain things, but they don't feel unreal or contrived. You know, Don Johnson is a kind of reactionary man who's kind of like mooching off his wife and also cheating on her. And he works yes, as that. He functions very effectively as that. He's believable. One of the best scenes in the movie is one where they're all sitting around having an argument about immigration. And Don Johnson, the sort of Trump guy, is getting all high and mighty about people coming into the country. They should come in, you know, legally. They should follow the rules. And of course, he calls Marta over. Marta is, you know, the
real star of the movie.
Yes.
The way that these movies are formatted is that essentially we have Benoit Blanc, played by Daniel Craig, doing the most. The one thing I will say that is better about Glass Onion is that apparently he like worked with a dialogue coach like way more closely in Glass Onion, and his accent is way better. In the first one, it is the most like foghorn, leghorn ass shit I've ever heard in my entire life. But regardless, I'll come back to that later because I have a point I want to make about it. But it pairs him essentially with someone in the one figure in the movie who is not a rich person, and finds themselves at the center of the murder mystery for one reason or another. And so in the first one, it's Marta. And in the second one, I can't remember her name, but she's played by Janelle Monáe. And it's actually that whole thing is sort of confusing and requires going into a bit more detail anyways. So I'll just set that aside. But yeah, you were talking about the scene where Don Johnson, who, by the way, I've really enjoyed Don Johnson's late career resurgence. Same. playing mainly buffoons and villains. I think that's really great. It's been a lot of fun to watch.
He's perfectly cast here. He's
everyone is really well cast in the first one. I have some quibbles, and I'll get to those in a second. But he pulls Marta aside and says, you know, they should do it right. They should do it like Marta and Marta's family. And of course, hilariously, Marta's family is actually also undocumented. So he's just pulling this out of his ass.
And actually, it's a good window into one of the things that made Knives Out very strong. And that was lacking in Glass Onion. In Knives Out, the original, you're always, Marta is your protagonist and your perspective. You are experiencing the story through Marta. And they are all of these characters are in a certain relationship with Marta that is about the class dynamics. So, you know, she is the help. She is the domestic labor. One of the running gags that actually works really well is that nobody knows what country she's from, and they all claim, you know, a different one. So they're like, oh, Marta, yeah, you know, she's from Ecuador. Oh, her family's from Bolivia. Oh, yeah. Right. Like, they're all different versions of Clued Out. Another, you know, of the funny gags is that Marta is not invited to the funeral of the patriarch of the family whose death, you know, is the center of the mystery. She's not invited to the funeral, and every member of the family separately says to her, you know, Marta, we're really sorry you weren't at the funeral. I thought you should be there, but I was outvoted. So, like, they all essentially try to pretend to Marta that they are on her side, and ultimately none of them are. They all treat her with varying degrees and
save
styles.
Maybe the like, granddaughter or whatever, the kind of like the youngest,
yeah,
not the stupid alt-right shoehorned in teenager, yeah, but the next youngest, like, she's Toni Collette's daughter, I believe, yeah, if I remember correctly. It's been a while since I've seen the first one. I watched Glass Onion last night, but I wasn't gonna watch both of them again. I probably will rewatch Knives Out at some point, because I'd like to kind of tighten my, like, how I feel about it.
It holds up better, and it's funnier. It's more enjoyable to watch.
It is funnier. The granddaughter's name is, who's Toni Collette's daughter, she is actually the one person in the family who I think it would be, say, I would say it's unfair to say that she's not on Marta's side at all.
Right.
She feels like she's kind of pulled in two directions. And I think she is the one character who seems like she is genuinely, like has a genuine sense of worrying about Marta and having concern for her and her well-being, as opposed to everyone else who's just full of shit. And of course, yeah, Christopher Plummer as well, as the rich guy who dies, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Also, like, you know, again, like, it's I'm not saying that the relationship is, like, good, or that he's, like, a good guy or anything, but he is, I would say he's also the only one in the family, really the only one in the family, and that's why it's a big deal that he dies, that actually did like her.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Whatever
yeah.
that means for a person in that yeah. position.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think with the girl's name is Meg, the younger daughter, it's that she's the least disingenuous with respect to Marta. She cares about Marta in a way that's real. But I think, you know, one of the film's strengths is the way that it shows that when push comes to shove, like, she fucks her over too.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and,
that is
and she
true.
Feels,
yeah.
She feels bad about it. She regrets it. But, like, she ultimately, you know, she slides back into her class power, basically, right? Like, yeah. she despite her best liberal intentions, you know, remains embedded within the family, the rich family. This is the strength of Knives Out, is that everyone is tethered in their class relationships, and it's all happening sort of towards Marta, and you see it as the way that the different ways they treat her. Glass Onion doesn't have that because, you know, our working class character is in disguise as another rich woman throughout most
well,
of the
yeah.
film.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
And
I
we'll
know.
Get to that. And
I know.
I want to kind of, I want to sort of compartmentalize, the discussions of both movies, at least at first, because I just know as soon as I go down the Glass Onion track, it's going to be really hard to get off of it. But
yeah,
I actually want to return to the scene that you described in a second, because I have some thoughts about it. But before I do that, I also want to talk about, like, you say that, you know, like, Knives Out has you know, a certain class analysis and element to it that is basically lacking from Glass Onion, at least in terms of sophistication. Like, you could argue that they both have the same observation, but it's just one is kind of fumbling with it, and the other is like it's tighter.
Yeah,
but I would say Knives Out has a lot of things that Glass Onion doesn't have. It has a better cast. Yeah. It has better performances, I would argue, except for maybe Daniel Craig, who I'll return to later. It looks better, in my opinion. Like, and this is subjective, because Glass Onion actually looks quite good too, and it's one of two things that I give it credit for. Like, both movies have a certain visual panache to them. They're very memorable. Like, you're not going to forget what these movies look like.
Mm-hmm.
You might forget everything else about them, but you'll remember, like, the sort of the color palette. And, you know, in Knives Out, it's a very it's very murder mystery-esque. Yeah. It's
November.
It's this
it all feels November.
Yeah, exactly. It's this very autumnal color palette of maroons and oranges and sort of these dark sort of like reddish colors. It's very, you know, it feels like, and this is actually a thing that they kind of fumble the ball with it, in my opinion, a little bit, but like that house and the whole movie pretty much, that, because most of it takes place in one location with a few exceptions, it looks like it could be really any era almost, you know. It actually is a little bit like the house from Ready or Not. It feels in some ways like it could be from the early 20th century or something, mm-hmm. or it could be the 70s or it could be the 60s. And so, you know, it looks great. It's got good performances. I do have some complaints about it that I'll talk about in a second. But the thing that I think it does really well is it lays its cards on the table almost immediately by saying basically, like, okay, there isn't actually a murder mystery, really. Like, we're telling you what happened. This guy accidentally overdosed on drugs that Marta gave him, and it was unintentional, and you know it's unintentional, mm-hmm. right? And so the intrigue of the movie is basically, what is going on? Like, what? Okay, so we know what happened, so there has to be more to it.
Yeah, and like, why is everyone lying? Everyone's lying, and yet we know that, like, this was an accident. This appears to have just been an accidental thing, but everyone is lying about that night.
Yes. And then the other interesting element that's tacked onto it is that, yeah, so you know that he accidentally overdosed because of her. And so there's this other element to it where you're rooting for her, right? Like, there's no question, even though Benoit Blanc is like the charismatic like star of the movie or whatever, I don't want to say protagonist because Marta really is the protagonist, but, like, you know, he's the Han Solo or whatever, you know, to her, like Luke Skywalker or Leia or whatever, where it's like, okay, he might be not technically the protagonist in the sense that he moves the plot forward, or that he is like the person that is at the center of the conflict that you want to win, but he's the charismatic, like, gravitational center of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you root for Marta at his expense. Like,
yes.
The whole time you're watching it, you're like, I hope he doesn't solve the mystery because I want Marta to get away,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that then eventually what ends up happening is you end up finding out that there's more to it than, and that, you know, like, spoiler alert, whatever, like, she didn't actually overdose. He didn't overdose on her drugs. It's the shithead, you know, I call them all like sons and daughters, but I think he's the grandson. He's Don Johnson's kid, right?
Yeah. And it's actually a really, I mean, I think having just watched it last night, it's a pretty elegant, it's an elegant intrigue. It's an elegantly written, you know, story. The plot is intricate. The different pieces of it make sense. All of the characters' motivations make sense based on who they are. And like, it actually comes together in a really, really clever way, so that by the payoff at the end, in spite of it, as you say, the structure is like, you know right from the start that like there wasn't a murder in the traditional way. So
yeah,
the way that it pays off ends up being really satisfying, which again,
and it doesn't get too cute, right?
No, it doesn't.
Like, it's one of those things where the fact that it ends up being Chris Evans, it's not shocking. Like, it makes sense based on, you know, all of the different people in the movie. It's not like if you found out at the beginning of the movie, like if someone spoiled it for you and they were like, oh, well, it's Chris Evans, you would be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of tracks, you know, that's not a huge shock. But the way that they get there is interesting and compelling.
Well, it's almost like he's like a reverse red herring, because they set him up so hard early on to seem like, yeah, this guy's a shit who probably is responsible at some level for some bullshit. And they very, very gradually walk it back so that you start to gradually think like, oh, you know, maybe he wasn't a shithead, only to discover that he was in fact a shithead even more than you realized.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It plays out really well. And like, I think that it stays contained within what it's trying to do. It does a really good murder mystery. And while there is this class commentary to it, the class commentary doesn't take away from the entertainment value of a good murder mystery. It adds to it in many ways, I think, and does it for the most part, I think, quite well. There are a couple of characters where I think it really fails, it really flops, because it's very clear to me that the director doesn't understand the kind of things he's sending up. But with those exceptions, and we can talk about the ones. I mean, it's the two young kids. Those are the ones I'm talking about.
Well, okay, so that's fair. I was going to say that's where I sort of disagree with you, is that like my biggest complaint about this movie, I have two biggest complaints about this movie. The first is, you know, I'm intrigued to rewatch it and see if I still feel this way, but like Daniel Craig was just really not working for me in this. And I guess that's probably somewhat subjective, but he felt like the whole time I was watching him, I'm just kind of listening to his voice and seeing him affect this sort of weird Southern, you know, very non-specific, like Southern, is he a Southern gentleman, or is he is he more hardscrabble than that? Like, it's never really clear, I guess, from his like his affectation or whatever. And just basically the whole time I'm watching him, I'm just thinking like, this is such a bizarre choice to have him do this voice and be this guy. Some people might disagree with me on this and whatever, that's fine. But like, I just don't see how that decision is any better than just having him do his normal voice and be British. I don't know. I didn't think it was a good performance personally. It improves drastically in the second one, in my opinion. And I remember talking to my wife about it, because she had done some, we watched both the movies together, and she had done some like reading about it or whatever, and I was like, yeah, you know, this first one, like, you know, Daniel Craig really wasn't working for me or whatever, and she was like, oh, well, like, that's too bad, because apparently everyone says that like he's the best part of Glass Onion, And I'll tell you something. Those people were dead right. He is the best part of Glass Onion, and that's why Glass Onion isn't very good. So, you know, that's subjective or whatever, but there were certain things, like just with his character too, where I could tell Rian Johnson thought he was writing lines for him or writing things for him to do that he thought were so fucking funny that just fell completely flat for me. The donut thing, it's one of those things that it can be hard to put my finger on what it is exactly about it, because it's not like, it's not quite that it's smart ass. It's not quite that it's too, you know, Joss Whedon-y or whatever, but there's a certain thing that happens where you have an interesting movie with an interesting plot, and it's coming to its conclusion and you want to know how it ends. And then we keep taking breaks from that to do jokes. And I realize that, you know, if you're making a comedy or you're making a movie that's supposed to be funny, that's the point. And and, like, you know, I'm sure there are some people listening to me right now just being like, what, you're mad that they put jokes in this movie? And it's like, no, I'm not mad that they put jokes in this movie. I'm mad that, like, the stakes are very high and we've reached the point of the movie where there's maybe like people's lives hanging in the balance of this. And
he's busy, like, the donut has another hole and there's a hole inside the hole. Of
exactly.
The donut.
And it's like, okay, where's the fucking urgency here? Like, the best example I can think of this actually is, I rewatched The Social Network, a little while ago. Dog shit movie, by the way. Like, people haven't watched it in 12 years, and so they think it's like good. It's not. It's not a good movie. Like, it's a well-made movie with complete shit in the center of it. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, it's like got good music by Trent Reznor, and the direction is really tight, but like the script sucks. Its observations are stupid. And big surprise, it's written by Aaron Sorkin. So whatever. Mm-hmm. But like, there is a scene, it should be a great scene, where at the very end, Andrew Garfield and Jesse Eisenberg, who plays Mark Zuckerberg, I can't remember the name of the Garfield guy, they're arguing about like Garfield being completely cut out of the company and having like his share decreased through fuckery to like less than 1% of the total of the company, right? And they're having this like knockdown drag out fight about it, and it's really like emotional, and their performances are good, and it's an example of like Sorkin can kind of do this kind of dialogue, and so their dialogue's good, and the entire time it's just being interrupted by Justin Timberlake being a complete smartass and just making the stupid jokes that aren't funny. And it's like, it completely ruins it. Like, it's just, and you know, here I am just going off on a rant about a different movie or whatever. And it might actually be worth it to do either that or a Sorkin episode at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But like, this is a thing that really bothers me, that I struggled with through both of these movies, and I've struggled with in other movies, where it's not that I have a problem with jokes or with someone trying to be funny. It's just that it seems sometimes like it's unearned. And this is a complaint I have about Rian Johnson's writing throughout both of these movies. Like, you have Daniel Craig talk in this stupid Foghorn Leghorn voice the entire time, and you're thinking to yourself the entire time, why does this guy sound like Foghorn Leghorn? And then at the end of the movie, Chris Evans is like, oh, fucking Detective Foghorn Leghorn here or whatever. And it's just like, you're the fucking one who made him sound like that, dude. That's not funny, because like, you're just saying the thing that we all fucking thought for 2 hours. But of course we all thought that for 2 hours. You made it that way. You know what I mean? Like, I realize that like that's how writing works or whatever, but there's just a certain like there's a certain thing where it's like, well, you don't get points for pointing out the thing that, like, Mystery Science Theater 3000 would point out about something 5 minutes into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. It's not, it's laboring to be funny, but it's like setting up a dialogue between two characters that, you know, where one character is making fun of the other, but you've written the initial character to be a certain way. And so, like, of course your second character is going to make fun of that. You know, you could have I get it. I get what you're saying.
Like, it's a surface level thing to make fun of them for.
Yeah. And there's,
you know what I mean? Yeah.
There's a labor to some of the jokes. There's a laboring to be funny. When you're watching a movie that's supposed to be funny, you shouldn't really be aware of the movie trying to be funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
You should be finding it funny, and you should almost be surprised. Like, you should almost be caught off guard that it's funny because you weren't expecting. I mean, that's sort
of the point.
That's
what
comedy is, in a way, is like the unexpected. And so when you can see the strings of the marionette, it kills the effect. And there's times in Knives Out, and there's many more times in Glass Onion, where you can see the strings. You can see the person crafting the joke, thinking, oh man, this is going to be so funny. People are going to love this. And that kills it. Like, those moments. Now, I think that Knives Out actually has several moments where you don't see the strings, and it is very funny.
It is funny at times. I agree.
Especially, like, and I think, like, I'm on the same page as you, because the examples you're giving tend to be the ones that feel really try hard. They feel forced, like try hard jokes. You know, having watched it just last night, I don't remember the actual line, but there's a scene where the family's all fighting and voices are kind of overlapping and the camera's moving away from the room, but you still kind of overhear some of the things being yelled. And I don't remember what it is that he says, but Michael Shannon has a line where his voice just kind of rises above them all, something he's yelling that is actually, for me, the funniest line in the movie.
Sure.
And it's like, these things are often happening. You've got such a good cast and, you know, who all just like give themselves over to the characters that they've been given. And so there is a lot of pretty funny stuff that comes out of that, but it's the moments where you can feel the writer in the room with you being like, hey, do you think this is funny? Hey, I wrote this joke. Do you want to listen to this joke that I wrote?
Yeah. Yeah,
and that
exactly.
Kills it, right.
Well, one thing but before I put a pin in the Daniel Craig thing, at least for now, one thing that I read that made me so mad afterwards was that there was they had considered in the development of Glass Onion getting Daniel Craig to do a completely different accent for the movie, and of course they're going to make a third one, right? And so they toyed around apparently with this idea of, just with no explanation, having Benoit Blanc have a different stupid accent in every movie. And I will say, that would have been hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would have retroactively made everything that pissed me off about his performance in Knives Out, it would have like retconned it as being good and funny for me. And I'm really bummed that they didn't do that, because I think that would have like really heightened it, actually.
Yeah.
But this is kind of a thing that touches a little bit on my other complaint about it, which is that it simultaneously feels like, for the most part, this really self-contained world where everyone is, where, you know, it has this very distinct visual style. It sort of feels weirdly not tethered to the moment. Like, the fashion isn't necessarily, especially in the first one, isn't necessarily like, doesn't necessarily look like a late 2010s fashion. The people don't necessarily, for the most part, talk like it's the late 2000s. Like, it has this very timeless quality to it, but then it has things that it drops in that are clearly like very, very intentional attempts to attach itself to the zeitgeist and the current cultural moment. And that's why, like, I hated the scene that you singled out about the family arguing about immigration and stuff, because it felt like reading a Twitter flame war from like 5 years ago. And it felt kind of very, very tethered to, you know, 2016 when it was probably written.
Yeah.
And in a way that that hasn't aged well, like the observations or the things that they were talking about, like it didn't seem like it really needed to be there to me. Like, okay. Like, don't get me wrong. The part where he grabs Marta, like once it reaches that part, it gets better. And I think that, like, I understand why it's there, and I understand that the point he's making, I still don't think it really needs to be there. Like, I still think all that stuff is just implicit anyways, but that really didn't work for me. And then the other thing that really didn't work for me was the teenager, the alt-right kid. Like, yeah, that felt totally that shoehorned in.
Yeah.
It felt totally like, you know, basically like him whining that nobody liked The Last Jedi. That's what that felt like to me. Yeah, like, which, by the way, I liked The Last Jedi. I thought it was, I've defended that movie and Rian Johnson making that movie for a long time. It's not like great or anything, but I thought it was fine. I thought it was easily the best of those movies, the three. But it's one of those things where like, you know, does anyone even say alt-right anymore?
Yeah, you know? I know. The conversations between the two young, like the teenager and the college age girl, are really rough. They're the worst parts of the movie, and they're the parts that ring the least true. And yeah, I mean, you know, like, she calls him an alt-right douchebag or something, and he calls her an SJW. Totally. I mean, even things like the fact that he calls her an SJW, it's stupid because I don't think I've ever seen anyone in real life say the word SJW. Yes. I've only ever seen it written in tweets. Like, it's just a word that doesn't, I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit here, but it's like, it's a profound misunderstanding of that particular aspect of the zeitgeist, as you put it. Like, and I think.
No, I agree. Like, they both sound like words I've never heard real people say.
Exactly.
Only like journos and people online and like people, you know, blogging or whatever, arguing on Facebook or on the internet or something, and that can be something that like strikes the killing blow to your movie. I think we've even talked about it on the show before, is like having something in it that makes it seem like the person spends too much time on the computer.
You know, for me, it's like, it's a, so being someone who is like, you know, middle-aged, I'm going to give myself middle-aged,
right. Yeah.
Who still teaches. And I teach people who are like in their early 20s and sometimes late teens. I'm very conscious of, like, there's a certain art to staying relevant, staying connected with what's happening in the world and with where pop culture is at without doing the thing where you're like Steve Buscemi, you know, the Steve Buscemi meme where he's like, how do you do, fellow kids? And you look stupid because you're trying too hard to seem like you get it, and you don't quite get it. You almost get it, but you don't quite. And so I'm really, I think I'm really sensitive to that in particular, because I'm obviously like fucking terrified of the day that I slip into that is going to be a
fucking
nightmare.
Well, there's a level of it where the only way I think you can stay like quote unquote relevant is essentially it's kind of two poles. It's like, on the one hand, it really helps if you were never really in the shit anyways. With pop culture, like, I know for me, I've always been on an island culturally, so like it's easier for me to navigate changes because I always stay the same, you know. So it's kind of like, you know, this thing isn't in anymore, like fashion wise or whatever, and it's like, I've just always dressed like it was 1978, so it's not really a problem, you know.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing you do is like, you have to let go. Like, you have to not try so hard.
Yes, and that is exactly what I was going to say, is you have to accept on some level that, you know, I'm only 29, but like, I don't fucking know what it's like to be a 19-year-old.
No,
I know what
don't.
It's like to be 19, like in a you know, structure of feeling sense. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, like, I don't know what it's like specifically to be 19 in the year 2023. I have no fucking idea. I have some idea that, you know, and I can think to myself, well, what would it be like? You know, okay, I'm me and I'm 19. I have my 19-year-old brain and this is the shit I'm dealing with. But I don't know. No. You know, that's just and how
you
it can't, is.
And there's no way that you could, you know, effectively pretend that you did, because you just can't, you're not going to be able to quite get it. And you know, it's like, okay, one last kind of metaphor to make this make sense. When my students cheat, when my students plagiarize, yes,
sure,
they'll go online and copy something and then they'll put it through like thesaurus type software so that all the words are yeah, changed to words that are slightly different, but have the same totally basic meaning. And yeah, students think, there's no way he'll know. There's yeah, no way he'll know that this is not. And in fact, I know instantly. It's instantly obvious to me. And it's like students in that context, like they aren't so deep in like writing and words and language to be able to even realize how obvious their plagiarism is.
Sure.
And that's what pop culture is like. When you're mm-hmm, really in it, when you are like in the zeitgeist and you're part of it, like, you know, you can smell it the second someone steps into it who doesn't know what they're quite talking about. And yeah, so that yeah, scene with the two teenagers in Knives Out, where she's calling him an alt-right douchebag and he's like calling her a SJW bitch or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just, you instantly can feel that this person doesn't really quite get it. They almost get it. They think they get it, but they don't.
Yeah.
And so those scenes for me really fall apart. And like you say, I mean, it's the kind of thing that could, if there was a lot of it, it could absolutely kill the movie. Thankfully, it's pretty minimal. There's only a few yeah, of those scenes. And I don't find the rest of it. So the rest of it does not bother me in the same way. I agree yeah, with you that it's not going to age well because it is so
yeah, yeah,
totally of its moment. I mean, they have Toni Collette saying, kids in cages, kids in
yeah,
cages.
Yeah, yeah, right? Exactly.
Which is 100% the Trump era. It was 100% like... Mm. The border and
yeah, it's all AOC shit. No one says
Trump,
anymore.
Right? Yeah, no one talks about kids in cages anymore. It was of its moment. People are
doesn't
still
mean
held
they
in.
Shouldn't.
Yeah, yeah. I was
doesn't
gonna
mean
say,
they
people
shouldn't.
Are still,
it's just that they
right?
don't.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's one
but
of those.
Here's why it works. Yeah. Hang on. Here's why it
okay,
works.
Yeah.
Even though that is not going to age well from a audience's understanding it standpoint, it works well because it actually makes the exact point that we just made. Toni
yeah,
Collette is the
I
liberal.
Have.
Right,
yeah, I have
she's
some time
sitting
for that.
There. She's saying kids in cages, and it sounds like she's real about it, but she fucking isn't. And you, as the audience, kind of know instinctively that she's full of shit and that she's just this liberal performing a certain kind of thing, which she can do because it's the Trump era. And guess what? Watching the movie in 2022, she mm-hmm, rings exactly as hollow as like she is supposed to, as those types of liberals did. So for me, a scene like that actually works, even though the specifics of it, like they will not age well. An audience 10 years, 20 years from now will not get it because like none of that yeah, stuff will even resonate anymore. But for the point that it's making of its of that moment, I think it lands really well. Unfortunately, yeah, the Glass Onion fails at that tries to do that same thing.
Yes.
Be yeah, right in the zeitgeist, be right in the heart of pop culture. But it doesn't work because I think the points that it makes are not as good. They're just not as
yeah,
strong.
Yeah, this segues really nicely into the second movie because it is really like, you know, so for me, my problem with that scene is that it lands kind of in, I guess, almost like the uncanny valley, something being simultaneously a little too close to reality, but not close enough that it feels like, ah, ha, ha, so true. You know, like, mm-hmm, oh, that's so on the nose. Like, that's so perfect. That's such a perfect distillation of what things are like. It falls just sort of short of that. And as a result, for me, I'm watching it and it feels like it's like, okay, this either isn't like accurate enough or funny enough to overcome just how cynically like pulled from a Twitter thread it feels. For me personally,
mm-hmm,
where Glass Onion really fails, in my opinion, is that it takes all the stuff that kept taking me out of Knives Out and that I kept kind of like grumbling about while I was watching it,
mm-hmm.
and makes that the movie. Mm-hmm. It's like Glass Onion is a movie for people who liked all the stupid bad shit from the first movie. Like it's like there's more Daniel Craig being Daniel Craig, although I will say I do actually think he's better and funnier in Glass Onion than in Knives Out. Whether that's just a function of him being in a worse movie so he looks better by comparison, that's maybe up for debate, but like, you know, it's got more of that. It's got more like, hey, remember when you read this on the news? Like, mm-hmm. A person I follow on Letterboxd, a guy I know from Twitter, said, like, in a positive review of the movie, he said something along the lines of, like, ah, it's pretty good. Like, I liked it. But it is ultimately, like, a movie for parents who want to hear about stuff they know about from the news.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, like, totally. That is 100% what it feels like. And it's just, like, every character for me just falls in that liminal space that I just talked about, mm-hmm. of being like simultaneously too similar to an existing thing, mm-hmm. but not similar enough for me to be like, oh, this is realistic. Like,
mm-hmm. it's like they're exaggerated versions of the particular stereotype,
mm-hmm.
but not in ways that are funny, exactly. and in ways that kind of actually miss it a little bit, you know, like the Kate Hudson's character, who, you know, kind of constantly is dropping in these things about how she accidentally said a slur, you know, and why do people get upset? I just said one slur. And it's like, you know, you could have done this in a way that was either, you could have either taken it further and had her be like more egregious, which probably could have been funnier, like, or you could have dialed it in a little bit, but you locked into the worst big part. It's like, it's a generic thing that any person could have come up with the idea of someone who accidentally, quote unquote, accidentally says slurs and doesn't understand that's bad. Like that is not creative. And
And it, the same thing with like when you find out what, like there's a scene later where you basically find out that she agreed to have her pants made in a sweatshop because she thinks a sweatshop is a place where you make sweatpants.
Yeah.
And it's like, that could be funny. But it's not in the movie. Like, it's not presented in a way in the movie that's funny. It's presented in a way that, and this is like my lingering complaint about Glass Onion, is that by the time they make the joke or by the time the thing happens, it is so plainly obvious what is either mm-hmm. about to happen or what the joke is that you're like yawning. In my opinion, anyways, like I'm fucking yawning by the time they get to the point of making the joke. Like, mm-hmm. you got to make the joke before I have the thought.
Exactly.
You know, if I have the thought before you make the joke, then you're just telling me what I think. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I don't think I'm some like amazing, perceptive fucking movie watcher necessarily. Like, I think a lot of people are smarter than this, you know? And so that was really the thing that throughout the entire movie really bothered me, was like, you know, and we'll talk about it with Miles Braun, the Elon Musk stand-in, I think, mm-hmm. as the most obvious example. But like, you know, here, I'm just going to very quickly, because I watched this one last night and I took a couple of notes. And so I'll list out like a couple of complaints I had about this particular thing here. The first is like, okay, so the alt-right guy, or not, and here I am saying alt-right again, but the manosphere influencer mm-hmm. guy, mm-hmm. the perfect example of your character not making any sense or trying to jam too many things together. This guy is supposed to be the first guy to ever get 1 million viewers on Twitch, right?
Mm-hmm.
He has a big giant house and a bajillion vintage cars and a really hot girlfriend, and he lives with his mom.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, that doesn't work.
No,
that just doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. It's not funny.
Yeah.
It just is like, okay, well, why does he live with his mom?
Mm-hmm.
He can only live with his mom.
Exactly.
If it's just that like he's rich and he moved his mom in with him, then that actually makes him seem, in spite of being an idiot and a Like, exactly. It makes him seem kind of nice, actually.
And that's,
like,
that is part of the problem with him. They set you up at the start, very, very start, to have him. He's this, like, raging misogynist. And yeah. then everything they do after that really makes you, like, increasingly sympathetic to him.
He's actually the least shitty person of all of them.
Like, exactly.
He really does just seem like a guy who, like, a guy you probably know, guys our listeners probably know, who were nice guys and weren't, like, bad people, but who fell down the Joe Rogan rabbit hole and became, like, shitty right-wingers. Even if, like, they still don't have evil in their heart and in how they treat the people in their life,
which doesn't work doesn't work, because those kinds of guys aren't the ones who run the YouTube channels. They're the guys that watch them, right? There's a lot of guys like the character that is created around Dave Bautista in that movie who watch that kind of stuff and get kind of drawn into it and kind of sucked into it, but they're not the guys that create that stuff. The guys that create it are psychopaths. They're Andrew Tate, who fucking literally traffics children into sex servitude. Like, they're monsters. They're monstrous, monstrous people. And what the film gave us was, like, a nice-ish version of, but who is supposed to also be doing this monstrous thing. It doesn't make sense. You have to go harder on that. If you're going to have him be one of those characters, he has to be really bad. If not, then you have to dial it back and don't have him be this, like, leading Twitch streamer about the manosphere. Like, it just doesn't land, you know? It doesn't hold together.
Yeah, and this is only, like, semi-related to that, but the whole, like, COVID gun thing that cures you of having to get COVID or whatever, that the rich people all have because they're rich, that really bothered me. As much as I sort of got, first of all, making this movie have COVID in it is also a thing that completely dates it in a weird kind of way.
I don't mind that. I don't mind that, because, like, it's weird that there has been, like, a reluctance to do that at all. But
I agree. It's not done well, though.
Yeah, it's not done well. It's done in a way that makes it kind of irrelevant because of the stupid gun. It's lazy. Yeah. It's lazy writing.
And, it is.
And that film is filled with lazy writing where it's like, I mean, you could have actually done something about the COVID gun thing, made it explicitly about some kind of rich thing, you know, find some way to craft it so that it actually does speak to, like, rich people having easier access to medical care or whatever. But they don't. They're just, it's just like, hey, well, look, we needed a way to show you the actors' faces. So,
exactly.
We invented a gun to just do it. Like, don't think about this.
Also, to put in the patently obvious, like, Chekhov's gun of Duke being allergic to pineapple.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, just another thing from the beginning of the movie that really, like, set the stage for me right away that I was going to hate it is the scene dogs plus AI equals discourse. When I heard him say that, I was like, oh dear.
Yeah.
Oh dear. This is going to be, there's going to be some very labored jokes in this. And there were. On the note of,
it's too bad because that, and maybe this is in some ways going to be my point about the film. That, I think, is supposed to be. It is supposed to be dumb. It is supposed to be making fun of people like Elon Musk who don't actually who themselves don't understand internet culture and Twitter culture, think they do, make jokes about it, say things like stonks years after stonks was ever funny, if it ever was.
I thought it was funny the first time I saw it.
Okay, that's fair.
I'll admit it. Yeah,
that's fair. But, like, he still says it, right?
It's
like the film was trying to make fun of people who don't get it, but didn't realize that it didn't fully get it either. And so, it's hard to unravel in that sense.
I can't wait to get to the end of this. I can offer, like, because there is a weird way that this movie's total lack of self-awareness makes it almost genius. We're still far off from that. I want to get to the center of the bad writing thing.
Okay.
And it's connected to two things. So in the first one, the whole Marta flashback reveal, which I'm gonna say right now, I'm gonna nail down what I think Rian Johnson's like style is in these two movies. It's soy Tarantino, because it's got a lot of the snappy dialogue, but it's very Whedon-y at times. Yeah. And it's got the non-linear like flashbacks and, oh, you're seeing this thing from a different angle or whatever. But sometimes I would argue in the first one, it works quite well. But in the second one, it feels unearned. It feels mm-hmm. a little labored. And mm-hmm. I say this too, the font in Knives Out is almost identical to the Tarantino font, save for a couple of,
our resident Tarantino guy has spoken.
Yeah, exactly. It's got some flourishes with a couple of letters, but it's very similar to like the font that Tarantino uses in every movie. But so in the first one, that flashback thing works really well because it's like, this all makes sense now, right?
Yeah.
That's the way all of the flashbacks work in Knives Out. It's you realizing a thing, you know, you noticing that something was kind of off, and then we come back to it and you go, fuck, that's why that was off.
Yeah.
That's why that was off. It feels like you could have solved the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Like you were close, but you just couldn't quite put all the pieces together. And that's what a mystery should feel like. It should feel like a good mystery, unfortunately, has to run the risk that somebody watching the movie will figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I've done that before. Like we'll talk about Jordan Peele and Us at some point. I figured out the twist in Us in the first 5 minutes. It's still one of my favorite movies. It doesn't matter. Like if you execute well and you earn it doesn't matter. In this other one, the flashback is, it turns out that Janelle Monáe, the woman that you've been following for the last hour, actually has a twin sister, and it's been her twin sister the whole time, which is just about the most lazy soap opera ass writing thing you can do in a movie.
I was so upset when Ben Shapiro wrote his Twitter screed about Glass Onion. I was so upset
that he was right.
Acknowledge that he was right about that. Yeah. It is the laziest, and the way it's done is so lazy in this in particular, because there is nothing given to the audience, nothing to suggest that there's even going to be some kind of flashback and that these characters are going to be something else. Even our supposed protagonist, Benoit Blanc, is supposed to be our trusted narrator. And I don't think the film is trying to suggest he's an untrustworthy narrator. So he is supposed to be our trustworthy source, is pretending for the first hour of the movie. And you only find out that he's pretending in the flashback. Like that's not good writing. That's not.
Yeah.
You can't do that. That's weak.
Yeah. And this touches on the other thing that easily made me the most mad about the entire movie. The thing that made it like an arduous watch the first time through, pretty much throughout the whole thing. And that is that the Miles Braun character is, well, thing number one, Musk is the new Trump. He's the new guy that you can't make jokes about or you can't satirize, because the things that he does are more on the nose than the thing that you would come up about him, right? You would come up with about him.
Yeah.
The difference, to a certain extent, is that while Trump is hilarious and one of the best posters of all time, Musk is easily the worst of all time.
Yeah.
And really not funny at all, not even unintentionally. Things that happen to him are funny. And every once in a while, like the whole email thing where he sent out the email version of scrawling out a note on notebook paper and handing it to the girl in your class when you're 12 that says, "Do you like me? Check yes, no." And having basically everyone check no and quit.
Yeah.
Like, that's very funny, but that's not really him. Like, it's the thing that happened to him that was funny. He kind of didn't have as much to do with it or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's one issue that this movie has. It's just kind of like, you can't make a muskier character than Musk. Mm-hmm. And so all the stuff that they try to do with Edward Norton, it just doesn't quite land, in my opinion.
I have an answer to that one. I know that I know that critique, and I felt it watching. Like, I felt the same thing, right? And I said this, I think, on our last episode, or maybe I just said it to you in a DM, but...
Sure, yeah.
Like, this film was written... It has to have been written. Like, if you back up from the release date, we have to be talking a year, year and a half, maybe even 2 years.
That is
and
true.
2 years ago, the comedy of Elon Musk and his failures had
less
not
obvious.
Nearly come to light. Yeah,
yeah,
way
that
less
is true.
Obvious.
Less obvious.
It was not the center of attention. He was not the Trump. In fact, at 2 years, if you took 2 years ago, he was still a darling of the liberal media. So
to a certain extent, but I don't give anyone very many points for noticing that 5 minutes before everyone else does. Like, just because I understand your point, but I'll contrast it because I wanted to shoehorn this discussion of this in anyways. And you haven't seen the movie, so I won't spend too much time on it, but I'm going to contrast it with a movie that just came out that I just saw in the theater called Megan, that a lot of people have probably know what it is or have seen it. It's a movie about a girl whose parents die. She goes to live with her aunt. Her aunt's like a tech dipshit, and she builds her basically an AI lifelike doll that to be like her best friend or whatever, right? And AI is like the central thing everyone's talking about right now. It's the main character of Twitter. It's overtaken Musk as the main character of the internet now, right? But all of the things in Megan all feel like spot on in a way that is both observational and funny. It perfectly captures like the weird uncanniness of like, oh, like this actually does feel human for a second. And then it just veers completely off into a totally different thing. Like one thing that it does really well is like, just as an example, it's not spoiling too much or ruining anything, but there's a scene where the girl, the main girl, gets upset, and the doll Megan decides to start singing to her, but she picks like a sort of like B-list hit that no one remembers from like 2012, and it's deeply funny. Like it feels so perfectly like a song that you definitely heard when it came out but haven't thought about since, you know?
Yeah.
What? Oh, sorry. What? Here. What? Tell me that again. Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. So my wife just jumped in here with context for it. So the song is Titanium.
Okay.
Right? Which is, and what's funny about it is that, first of all, that's what she's made out of.
Yeah.
And then second of all, it's like a hyperpop song, but she sings it as a lullaby.
Right.
So it's like one of those things where I think the jokes in it land really well because they specifically avoid falling into that trap of being too close, but not close enough to real life. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like if you're going to be topical, you have to be really, really careful with how you do it. And you have to really nail it down. And so if you do it in a lazy way, you're going to be exposed. It's going to be exposed so easily, which I think is what happened with Glass Onion.
Exactly. I both like give him a little bit of credit, but and also feel a little bit bad for him that he was a bit behind real life. Like that this movie came out when it did and the observations that it made no longer felt novel or interesting in the way that they probably seemed like they did when he was writing it. But at the same time, if you're only that far ahead of everyone else, that's a tough one, you know? Like I may have even told this story on the show before, but like I had a friend who was working on a story for a long time. He's a writer, he's a fiction writer. He's working on a story for a long time, and it ended up being like the movie Elysium came out, and it was like, oh
yeah,
well, someone's done that now. The concept of like Earth is dying, all the rich people live on a like luxury like space station resort thing, while all the poor people have to live on the planet and die of global warming or whatever. And it's like, you know,
Yeah.
He could have very well written a way better version of it, but it's, they beat you to it, man. What can you say?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you lost fair and square. And that's kind of how I feel about this movie, is it's like, you could say, oh, well, who could have seen this coming? But I kind of think any observant person could have seen it coming. So I give him a little bit of a pass, because I understand that for him and his milieu or whatever, noticing that 2 years earlier probably is impressive in comparison to a lot of other people who are making movies or populating Hollywood. But, you know, at the end of the day, whether it's his fault or not, it just doesn't land. It just doesn't. It just feels trite by the time it makes it to the screen.
It does feel trite. I think that's a good word. Like, I think it feels like it's not nearly as profound as it purports to be. But I also, you know, as you're talking about this stuff, I'm thinking about, like, well, who are the people that buy into, like, the Elon Musk mystique, you know, or did, at least until recently? And it's like, it's my students. It's college students. It's lower middle class and working class youth who, you know, aren't spending half their life on Twitter because they have two jobs in addition to being college students. Yeah. And I mean, you know, they're plugged in certain ways. They're more plugged in than I am. But in other ways, they're less plugged in because they literally just have less time to spend on Twitter. And they're looking for ways out of the working class, which is what pretty much everyone in the working class is doing. And and people like Elon Musk drift in and present these ways out of the working class. I mean, that's not exactly what he purports to be doing, but it's like, that's what crypto is. Right. And a lot of Elon Musk's, like, when he was doing well, when his brand was somehow, you know, succeeding, a lot of it was about crypto. And my students love crypto. No matter what I do, no matter how hard I try to show them that crypto is bullshit and they're going to get burned, they still love crypto. Because
not to completely shit on your vocation and, like, your livelihood or whatever, but, like, this is just further proof to me that, like, I'm trying to think of the right way to put this. Like, when I finally went to college, I was like, oh, this is some horse shit. Like, and, like, this is just not like, and I don't mean so much like the institution itself or the instruction that I had or whatever. Like, I did learn some good things. But it really just, I looked around and I was just like, oh, these people are not smarter than, for example, like the people who wash dishes at my job. You know what I mean?
You mean like students?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I mean. And in many ways, like the grift that Elon Musk is doing is the same grift that universities and colleges are doing.
Yeah, you know what? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Great. Yeah, like, that's a perfect.
That's
way
what
of
it is.
It. Yeah.
And I'm in the classroom with students trying to teach them that, like, crypto isn't going to save them. But I mean, at the same time, they're in business programs promising them that at the end of this business degree, they're going to be out there as entrepreneurs running their own business, and they're fucking not. Like, that's not at all how the economy is. So, like, I'm fighting on multiple fronts when I'm in there, right? And
of course.
I'm trying to sort of, I'm always, like, trying to basically disavow my students of the grift that's being sold to them, you know, even by these institutions at times, but definitely by people like Elon Musk and with crypto.
Yeah.
And so, like, in that sense, when I think about it from that perspective, and I think about, okay, you and I might have, you know, we think we're very smart. We're on Twitter and we're plugged in and we're in the zeitgeist. You know, we could see through his bullshit years ago. Yeah, fine. But, like, a lot of my students didn't. And, like, they don't have the time, the skills, you know, like the critical thinking capacity to, you know, like, go as deep as we have. If they see a movie now, I'm not going to suggest that they're all going out and watching Glass Onion, because that would also be stupid.
No, probably aren't.
Like that, they're not necessarily the audience of the film. But to the extent that the film is a little bit late to the party from our perspective to say that Elon Musk is not smart. He's actually really dumb. And all of these people, Peter Thiel and all of these rich people that act like they're so smart and our society holds them up as being really smart, they're actually really fucking stupid. They're way stupider than you think. I mean,
That's actually the point.
Which is true.
It is true, and it's a point I am constantly trying to get across to my students. So in that sense,
and that's one thing that I will say is that I don't have a problem with either of these movies politically at all. Like, I might think the observations are trite, but they're not wrong.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
My complaints about these movies are purely on an artistic level.
Yeah.
Like,
and on execution rather than the
and execution.
Purpose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I don't have a problem with what they're trying to say at all.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with someone trying to make a Elon Musk is stupid movie. I personally think the best way to make an Elon Musk is stupid movie is to essentially make Iron Man, but no one, like,
the
Iron
doesn't
Man doesn't
work.
Realize that he's stupid and that and annoying and everyone hates him and that nothing he does works.
The iron suit just, like, punches itself in the dick repeatedly. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and this is, again, returning to Megan, like, I didn't, like, necessarily really pick up on this, but after I turned to my wife at the end and was like, what do you think, or whatever, and we had a conversation about it. She was like, it's about Tesla. And I was like, oh, I guess that does make sense. That's not what I took from it, but, like, she was like, no, it's obviously about Tesla. And I don't know if I agree with her necessarily, but, like, she was basically, she made a good point. She was like, well, it's about this, like, hot, new, cutting-edge tech product that's been rushed to production that just fucking malfunctions and kills people, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, yeah, that does sound like Tesla. Mm-hmm. And once again, like, it's just an example, I think, of, like, a better execution of a similar idea.
Yeah.
Where, and part of the reason that it works is that it doesn't really center the figure, like the CEO or whatever. There is a CEO in it, but he's not in it too much. He's not in it enough to feel like it's an attack on him. There's a broader critique happening where it's also about all of the people around him and the culture and capitalism always rushing things into production before they're really ready or safe, or who knows if they'll ever be ready or safe, or who knows what the ethical implications of it are. And that's why, like, I think, like, it feels prescient even now when the whole AI thing is at the very forefront of what people are talking about. This feels like it's a really smart, the humor is earned, the observations are even if they're simple, like, they hold weight, and I suspect that the movie will still be good 10, 15, 20 years from now. I suspect. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the stuff might not, like, some of the specific, like, the music references and stuff might not age well, but even still, like, I barely knew some of the songs that she sang. And just the fact that she is singing them in this weird robot AI voice is enough to make it funny, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, too, the thing about Glass Onion, I was thinking about this right before we started recording. I was thinking, like, what's a parallel that I could draw that would make this point? In a certain way, the characters, even though it's obvious what they're meant to be, right? They're obviously, it's like, oh, you've got your kind of racist influencer, you've got your, like, manosphere guy, you know, you've got your cynical politician.
Yeah.
The scientist guy makes no sense. He's not a stereotype of anything.
His character just doesn't make sense at all.
Like, he doesn't represent any piece of pop culture. He's just a guy that happens to work in a tech company.
Yeah.
And basically seems like an okay guy, but a bit of a coward. Anyways, setting that aside, like, we know what they're all supposed to be. Obviously Ed Norton is the tech bro type guy, but somehow it doesn't work. None of them quite land and none of them quite seem real enough. And and even though it's obvious what they're trying to be. And I thought of, I don't know if you've seen this movie, but the movie Hello Destroyer.
I love Hello Destroyer.
Oh, that is such a good movie. We should do an episode about it.
I've always wanted to do a Roxy Fever episode on it.
Oh, yeah.
I saw that movie when it came out in, like, a fucking, like, art house, like, screening or whatever. Like, I was so excited about it.
Oh, it was so good.
I've recommended it to people. Like, I recommended it to my dad. I recommended it to a friend of the show and friend of ours, Georgia Twiss. Just stellar reviews for that.
Yeah.
Just touching a little bit on hockey, my other podcasting interests. But yeah, great movie.
Yeah,
love Hello Destroyer.
Fabulous. Yeah. And
you know, compare Hello Destroyer. So for those that don't know, Hello Destroyer is about the hockey world. It's about like junior hockey in particular. It's about the hyper violence, the hyper masculinity, all of the ways.
The director said he wanted to make a movie about institutional violence.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that because it was in Canada, he chose hockey. Mm-hmm. He said if he was setting the movie in the States, he might have made it about the military.
That. It's the dark underbelly of Canadian society. It's everything that you know, hockey doesn't want you to know about the hockey world. And it's exceptionally well done. And it's brilliant. Real. And it feels like every character feels like someone I know. Every situation feels like situations that I have seen people go through. Everything about it rings true. Compare that to that fucking Jay Baruchel movie.
Goon?
Yeah, Goon.
Okay. I'm going to say, I do love
You're
Goon.
Gonna defend
the
Goon.
First one. Okay. The first one is great. The second one is stupid. It doesn't work. But the first Goon is funny. I understand your point.
Okay, you see my point, though, right? Because it's like...
Yeah, it's stupid. It doesn't have any good observations, really. Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And one of them gets it right. One of them reads the culture and understands the culture and is able to portray it. And the other is kind of getting at the same things. And yeah, I mean, granted, it's also a comedy versus a drama.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah, yeah.
But still, Goon is like trying to sort of draw attention to the same types of things. But for me, that's written and created by people who don't actually understand it, who don't actually have never lived it, have never really been close with people who have. Because one rings true and the other feels like a pantomime. That's the point
Baruchel's,
I want to make Baruchel about.
Baruchel has a book about being a Habs fan. I want to slightly just add to this.
Saving Jay
some
Baruchel.
Context. Like, Baruchel's in comparison to a lot of other people who populate that kind of space, like Baruchel was like a Bernie supporter. He's very like into that. You can tell like when you read his book that he's coming at it from a sort of irreverent, more certainly for the milieu, for for hockey culture, a much more left-wing perspective. But the thing about Jay Baruchel ultimately is he's a comedian. Right. So like his movies are very funny because or Goon, at least specifically, is very funny because it hits on a bunch of very funny, accurate observations about hockey, but it doesn't have anything to say. That's the difference. Right.
OK.
Like
yeah.
I say this because like I do just want to say that I think Goon functions as a comedy.
Yeah.
I just don't think it functions as like anything other than a comedy.
I'm going to go on record as disagreeing with you, although I take your point, but I disagree with you in the sense that I didn't think that Goon actually portrayed anything real. But like it actually did have some funny parts. And I agree with you there, but I didn't think accurately portrayed. I didn't think it understood the content it was joking about very well. Whereas Hello Destroyer understood it. And so to the extent that even, you know, we can disagree on that, but that's the point I want to make about Glass Onion, which is ultimately it doesn't really deeply understand the thing it's trying to make fun of. I'm all for making fun of the tech bros, knocking these people off their pedestals, pointing out that politicians are cynical and influencers are ridiculous and the manosphere is disgusting. Like all of that is worthwhile to do, but to do it right and make it land, you really do have to get it. You have to get it and you have to be able to like portray it in ways that ring true. And none of it in Glass Onion fully rings true. It all just ends up being like kind of sorta, but not quite. That's for me, that's the biggest problem.
I think that leads it nicely into kind of where I wanna how I wanna conclude this episode, which is a final observation about the Miles Braun character, and then my sort of full take on the movie itself and what makes it at the very least interesting and almost a kind of anti-genius, in my opinion. So the Miles Braun character is very obviously from the first moment you see him, a big giant moron doofus. There's no reasonable smart person who would watch this movie and not, at least in my opinion, like, and not immediately pick up on what a fucking moron he is.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Right?
Yes, agree.
And so this is another thing that I don't know, like, I can't talk to other people who have seen the movie, or I can, but like not all of them, you know, so I don't have a sample here, and I have no idea how unique or not unique this is, but I have a 60-inch television, right? So it's because I'm a fucking movie TV nerd and I watch hockey and I like to have a big screen. What can I say, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm not judging. No judgment. It's
No, yeah.
Good.
It was cheap. You know,
nice big TV. Good.
I watched it and...
Bourgeois asshole.
Yeah, it's my one. It's my, that and my musical instruments are my one bourgeois affectation in terms of things that I own anyways. I saw Edward Norton give his glass to Dave Bautista.
Oh, really?
I saw that. Like, I was watching it and I was like, oh, he just gave his glass to that guy. I have a theory about this that, like, this movie wouldn't have worked if it was released in theaters, because that would have been really obvious. Because I caught it on my, like, 60-inch screen. I can only imagine if you saw it on a real theater screen, like, maybe you're not paying attention. Like, it's kind of the central thing in the frame, though. And so I saw it, and I'm thinking the whole time, like, oh, okay, like, what's the hook here? Right?
Right.
Like, he did it. How are they going to make this interesting? That's the, like, it's kind of in the same, I'm thinking the same thing with Marta, right? Like, I'm having the same thought process of, oh, okay, they fed us this information, and now they're going to try to, like, make that interesting in some way, right? And so I don't know how many people would have noticed this, but I figure some of the home field advantage of people missing that is that this movie came out on streaming and a lot of people watched it on their iPad or their computer or on a small screen.
Or were distracted. I mean,
Or were distracted. Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, fine. That's also fair.
There's meant to be some misdirection happening.
For sure.
He's talking, you know, like.
Even absent that, though.
Yeah.
The fact that this guy is stupid and very obviously stupid is an obvious observation that anyone would have from the get-go. And then the movie for 2 hours, 3 hours, however long it is, like 2 to 3 hours, becomes an exercise in watching Benoit Blanc slowly figure out that a guy that we all know is stupid is stupid. This guy's right. Supposed to be the world's greatest detective.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff that he pulls together is pretty obvious. Like, some of the finer details, like the fact that he, you know, shot Janelle Monáe or whatever. Like, I don't think I picked up on that. Like, there's certain things that do feel like new information and that are like, oh, that's what was happening there. Although I will say, like the twin sister thing, they mostly all feel like you would never.
Yeah.
This movie's simultaneously completely obvious and completely opaque.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. And so when we finally get to the culmination, like the end scene of him just being like, you know, I do declare that this man is a moron.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I know.
Right.
We all know that.
Yeah.
But what does that have to do? Like, that is the thing that just the most feels like Rian Johnson. It's like he made a movie that was a quote tweet of Elon Musk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that is the thing, too. Like, you know, revealing my overly onlineness or whatever. But like, people were making fun of Elon Musk, like back when he got together with Grimes. There was the whole Italian Elon Musk Twitter account.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he has been a figure of derision for a while now. And I assume that that's probably where Rian Johnson got the idea. He probably follows some weird Twitter accounts or whatever and was like, oh, I should make a movie where Elon Musk is the bad guy. And so, like, most irritatingly to me, there is a part where they flash back to all of the stupid things that he says, all of the malapropisms. But like, I noticed all of those. You're not telling me anything I didn't know. Like, of course I know imbreviate's not a word. Of course I know it's inflection point, not infraction point. Of course I know that, you know, he's not the preeminent detective. Like, I understand that, like, for some people, like, I really don't want to be like, oh, I'm so smart and other people are stupid. Like, that's not what I'm trying to do here. Like, I understand that there will be some people are good at different things. I can't do math to save my life, right? So, like,
you put all your skill points into solving mystery murder movies.
Well, language, I think, more specifically. Like, that's the thing that I'm good with. I've written, I write music, I do this podcast. Like, I know words. Words are a thing that I know. Not everybody would necessarily catch that, like, preeminent, for example.
Right, right, right.
Is not the right word to use.
But that's
there.
Not even your point, because your point isn't that everyone has to catch it. Your point is that everyone should know by that point that he's dumb.
That this guy's an idiot.
And we do.
And guarantee everyone knows that imbreviate is not a word, and that's the first fucking thing that he says.
Yeah.
And so when they come back to it, it's like, well, who's the fucking idiot here?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You just figuring out that this guy's a moron? Like, you know, like, I understand that there's a bit more to it than that, but, like, it just feels very like, Jesus Christ, like, get on with it. We know. Why do you have to show us his malapropism? We all noticed.
Mm-hmm.
It's all so plainly obvious and so plain to see, and I understand that is to some extent the point. But it's not presented in a way that feels rewarding or interesting or compelling. It's presented almost kind of in a way that is kind of self-congratulatory, like telling the audience, like, oh, you're smart,
yeah,
and these people are stupid, and you should feel, you know,
yeah,
good for being smart. And I hate when movies do that.
Well, and it's doing something that, and I have a feeling this is, I've started to anticipate your final concluding point, but, and I might be, this is going to probably get you there, because in a way it's a contradictory thing. If you give the movie the most credit you can, it ends up being a very contradictory premise, which is the movie is trying to make a very clever movie, a very clever story and a clever case about a very dumb villain. Mm-hmm. And the very clever point at the end of the very clever plot is supposed to be that the villain is very, very dumb.
Yes.
And that's going to be a very contradictory thing to pull off.
Yeah, that is correct. Like, that is basically the central issue with the Miles Braun character. You know, I think you could do this in a way that would work. And I don't have a problem with this sort of idea that, like, it was so stupid that I missed it. If I also missed
if
it.
If you missed it.
But
yeah.
I didn't. Yeah. You know, if the audience also misses it. But I just feel like the audience is too smart to be in any way fooled by the world's dumbest man. Like, if there were certain elements, like, if it was executed in a way where you're like, Jesus, that's so dumb that I never even considered it.
Mm-hmm.
But it never quite lands that way.
Yeah.
And so you might say that I keep returning to the metaphor of the glass onion.
Something that seems densely layered, mysterious, and inscrutable, but in fact the center is in plain sight.
There is a line in this movie that hit me like a ton of bricks. It's at the very end where Daniel Craig says,
it's so dumb.
It's so dumb, it's brilliant.
No! It's just dumb!
And that perfectly distills why this movie is a metaphor for itself. Rian Johnson and the movie, like the writing of the movie, the execution of the movie, not so much Rian Johnson, but the movie itself, is Miles Braun. And the audience is Benoit Blanc. And it's this, at first appearing to be densely layered and complex thing, that is in fact just stupid and obvious. And, you know, I almost said that Miles Braun is the character that is the most similar to Rian Johnson, but I'm going to amend that, because I actually think if you look at both movies, who is Rian Johnson? Rian Johnson thinks that he's Benoit Blanc. He that's the stand in for him. That's who he thinks he is. But who he is actually is the 15-year-old alt-right teenager on the toilet posting and furiously masturbating to the punishment of his enemies. And because of that, I do think there's this weird, especially when you consider that it has a certain panache to it and a certain visual like punch. There is a kind of anti-genius to that, that he would kind of like unwittingly make this movie about how he is in fact doing the Miles Braun thing by making the movie itself. And that is kind of a glass onion, in that the more layers you peel back, the more obvious it is. And so I kind of like that about it in a weird sort of way.
Yeah.
But I found it, at least the first time through, to be quite arduous to watch, because it just felt like, you know, attending a lecture on a subject you already know a lot about, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, not learning anything new, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By someone who kind of vaguely gets it, but doesn't quite. Again, by that, yes, professor who, you know, knows about Twitter and knows about how some things happen on Twitter, but is not deep in enough to really be able to distill it and not seem out of touch. So yeah, it seems out of touch. Like it feels out of touch in a way that the original movie did not most of the time, like with the exception of those two younger
certain
characters.
Things.
In the first movie, it didn't feel to me out of touch with, you know, what are those types of people like and what are those types of people going to say? Whereas this one did. This one didn't. It did not feel like, my guess is that Rian Johnson probably has friends who are all of those characters in Knives Out.
Yeah.
Like he knows those people well. And so he's able, and the actors know them. Whereas in this one, I mean, do you think Rian Johnson has any friends who are like Manosphere Twitch streamers? Probably not, you know? I mean, good for him that he doesn't, but like,
yeah, totally.
It tracks that he would not fully understand like what that person is, and he would not be able to characterize it. And it does make the whole thing fall apart. I think you're right. I think you're right that the movie is far less intelligent than it thinks.
Yeah.
Just as, and I mean, it would be a stroke of brilliance if that was somehow intentional, but I don't think anyone sets out to intentionally make a movie that's dumb. So I don't think we can, but it is funny. It is interesting that it happened, where the movie is just as its main antagonist is supposed to be much less smart than he thinks. So is the film, unfortunately.
So goes Glass Onion.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And just on a final note too, like, The ending with the Mona Lisa thing, that fucking pissed me off so much, too.
Yeah, why are you burning the Mona Lisa?
Of fucking course. Because, I mean, because once again, it's like, well, you only said the thing about the fucking Mona Lisa a billion times.
Yeah.
You know, so, and you know, there were just things that about the whole thing where, like, the whole conclusion where it just felt like it took the most obvious and least interesting route. Like, if at the end it doesn't matter, and he does convince everybody to just defend him, that's probably more interesting.
Yeah.
You know, if the thing just explodes and everyone dies, that's probably more interesting.
Yeah. Come to think of it, why redeem them all?
I know. I didn't like that.
Right.
And also, by the way, if you're going to have fire in a movie, either have VFX fire or real fire. Don't show us real fire at the beginning. And then tack on the most obvious VFX post-production fire. It looks like shit.
It was bad. I tried in my head to say, oh, I guess that's just how the flames will burn with that weird clear stuff.
It looked bad.
Yeah. And why redeem them at the end? I hadn't thought of that until just now, but like, you've already established that they're a bunch of fucking cowards, and you did it, you know, not 20 minutes earlier, 20 minutes before the end of the film. You establish that even when push comes to shove, they are still going to be cowards. So why redeem them at the very last minute? That's not, you know, it's not good.
Yeah. I think it's funny. I find it interesting that, that like the more we talked about it, and the longer time you had to think about it and to analyze it, that like you've got basically covered out on being like, you know what?
Yeah.
This is not very good.
I peeled away the layers and I found it to be dumb.
Disliked it less the second time.
Yeah.
I was only half watching it, but I kind of, it's the charm that it does have shone through a little bit more the second time, when I was able to kind of be like, okay, there's some things here that are like, you know, the Dave Bautista character doesn't work at all, but he is at least fun.
Mm-hmm.
Certain things like that, it looks good. You know, yeah. Actually, Daniel Craig was working for me more in the second one. Like
the funniest character in the movie is actually Dave Bautista's mom in the opening scenes, mm-hmm. like understanding, like better than any of these other people, knowing all of the stupid tricks in the stupid box. There's a bit where she's in the background in the kitchen and you just hear her voice waft over saying, "It's a Fibonacci sequence." It's like, that's one of the best lines.
The first scene, other than the fact that he lives with his mom doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
The first scene where he's introduced is kind of funny.
Yeah.
And is where he's like, you know, or whatever, he's like, "I want to apologize about my comments about boobs," you know, and then his girlfriend comes in and she's like, "I love my boobs. Sorry, feminists." I was like, that was funny. Like that was like,
yeah,
like it wasn't hilarious, but it was like, yeah, okay, that's, you know, that feels true to life. But then it kind of. They introduce him, and that's the most accurate it gets.
Yeah, exactly.
And it just gets worse and worse over time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I will say, I think based on at least how I felt watching it the first time, this is Glass Onion, not Knives Out. Knives Out is a solid 3.5, but Glass Onion is my least favorite of the movies that we've watched, aside from, obviously, the Boondock Saints.
Yeah.
Which is bro Tarantino.
Yeah,
it's the the much worse other side of the coin of Soy Tarantino, which is still a marked improvement.
We'll have to do one of those XY axis graphs, you know, like the charts with, you know, Tarantino at the center and then all the different Tarantinos placed in different places on the chart.
Honestly, it would be funny to do like a Tarantino ripoff episode. Yeah. It would be hard to find enough movies to talk about, but I do love that phenomenon. And this is not, you know, these are not really hugely Tarantino ripoffs. They just have certain, the like, font. They wouldn't exist without Tarantino.
It's the font. It's all the
it's
font.
It's font specifically, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all right, about that
so
font.
You're saying 3.5 on Knives Out.
On Knives Out, two. Okay. 2 out of 5 for Glass Onion. Maybe at my most generous 2.5.
Yeah, I think I land on, I give Knives Out the original 3.5 to 4. I like it better than you, but I think I'm a solid 2 on Glass Onion. I don't even think I'd offer it the 2.5. I think I've landed on 2.
Yeah. All right.
When I finally realized at the end that they should never have been redeemed at the end, that actually really pissed me off like just 10 minutes ago. So it lost a half point just right there.
All right. Well, I hope people enjoyed this one, and I hope that I don't know. Maybe some people are going to see the light now. Maybe this will piss people off even more than the Bong Joon-ho episode. I guess we'll find out. I will say though, like all those Bong Joon-ho movies fucking rule, like massively over this shit in terms of like all my writing criticisms are so piddling in comparison to this one. So rate and review us on the podcatcher of your choice, and we'll see you next time.